In popular perception, the Declaration of Independence enunciated America's creed, a kind of political philosophy of the nation to which we should aspire to live up. According to Martin Luther King Jr., for example, in his famous I Have a Dream speech, this was the founding set of principles of the United States, and anything that the American people might do that does not meet the benchmark established by the Declaration of Independence is somehow falling short of national purpose. The actual content of the Declaration of Independence, however, gives the lie to this idea. There are four sections in the Declaration of Independence. Of course, first comes the preamble, which reads, "When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation." So right from the beginning of the Declaration, we see that its purpose is not to enunciate a national creed, but rather to explain, quote, "the causes which impel them to the separation." The second section of the Declaration of Independence, following this introductory preamble, is the most famous philosophical one. That's the one that includes the statement that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. For a very long time, scholars have taken the second section of the Declaration of Independence as being a reflection of Thomas Jefferson's, that is, the Declaration's chief author's, Lockean political principles. This idea that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and later that all men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that government is created among men to protect these rights, and that whenever government does not live up to this purpose, the people who are living under it rightly can abolish and replace it, has been taken, as I say, to reflect the ideas laid out by John Locke in his famous second treatise on civil government. However, it turns out that that's not the entirety of what the underlying philosophy of the second section of the Declaration is. And we'll come back to that point later on in this discussion. The third section of the Declaration of Independence is the one that now is most often ignored completely. And in fact, it's very common in anthologies of American political thought to find that the third section of the Declaration is omitted altogether. One very popular American political philosophy anthology includes only an ellipse when it gets to the enumeration of charges against King George. But in the 18th century, when people considered the Declaration of Independence, it certainly must have been the enumeration of charges against King George that struck them most forcefully. Here we have the Continental Congress explaining why the states are making themselves independent, and obviously the chief reason has to do with their complete dissatisfaction with their former king. So, enumerating various ways in which he's supposed to have been depriving them of their rights has to have been the most persuasive part of the Declaration of Independence. Among the claims made against King George were that he had dissolved assemblies and not let them meet for years on end. That is, that, for example, in New York, the legislature had been essentially prorogued and not called back into session, and there was no indication that it soon would be. He had sent foreign mercenaries to subdue the American colonists. He had encouraged domestic insurrection, which of course meant servile, or we might say slave insurrection. He had encouraged the what the Declaration called savage Indians to attack the colonists. He had reconstructed, the Declaration says, our governments, by which, of course, it was only referring to some, most notably Massachusetts after the Massachusetts Government Act. He had allowed Parliament to tax them without representation, the colonists said. And finally, he had closed the port of Boston, which, like the reorganization of the government of Massachusetts, was product of one of the coercive acts of 1774, what Sam Adams and other Whig North Americans were prone to call the Intolerable Acts. The next section of the Declaration of Independence is a plea to the American colonists' British cousins. You might think that people in Britain, for example, reading this would think, well, if you had complaints, why is this the proper way to address them? And so in that section of the Declaration of Independence, the Congress says, it's not that we haven't tried to call these things to your attention, we've petitioned repeatedly, and in fact, over the previous decade, the North American colonists had petitioned the King, the Lords, the Commons, the Mayor and Aldermen of London, the Bishop of London, the Bishops in general, the other people in the British home islands as they came to mind, and there had been essentially no response. And that's what that section of the Declaration asserts, that we've called these things to your attention, and neither justice nor consanguinity, that's Jefferson's word, had driven the British to make their government change its policy in any way. And so ultimately, the Declaration says that we're going to have to consider people in Britain as we do people in other lands, enemies in war and in peace, friends. In other words, you could have had us as your continued countrymen, but you decided you didn't want to. Finally, lastly, came the actual Declaration of Independence, the last section in which the Congress said that the colonies, quote, are and of right ought to be free and independent states, and that they could do what states could do. Notice nowadays we tend to lose the significance of these claims because we hear the word states in a 2013 context. It's come to mean subdivisions of the gigantic world-bestriding empire that is the USA of 2013. But in 1776, that wasn't what the word state connoted. Instead, its connotation was a sovereign entity. So, not Yorkshire in England or Andalusia in Spain, but Britain or Spain. So, the colonists weren't saying that each of the states was a subdivision of some great entity, but instead they were saying that each of the states was on a par in international affairs with the Netherlands or with Sweden, with Russia, or with Britain itself. And the part about their being able, the states being able to do what states could do, hurriedly got to the point that they could enter into treaties, they could make alliances, they could make commitments. In other words, Your Majesty in France, Your Majesty in Spain, to the rulers of the Netherlands, to Italian bankers, and to anybody else who might be interested in entering into a treaty or giving the Americans a loan of money, hey, we can be relied on as any other country can be relied on to keep our commitments. Clearly, the different sections of the Declaration of Independence were written for different groups of people. So, for example, that second part of the Declaration of Independence in which the colonists assert that governments are instituted among men to protect their natural rights, and that in case the government fails to satisfy the citizenry is entitled to abolish and replace it, cannot have been written for the Bourbon kings of France and Spain. On the other hand, it might very well have been expected to persuade some people in the colonies. And we should remember that at the time the Declaration of Independence was promulgated, it's unclear exactly what portion of the people who lived in these 13 colonies were supporting the revolutionary cause, but it certainly was not all of them. And estimates of the portion of people who were Tories, that is, who were loyalists, who sided with the king in the revolution, have varied from about a third to about 10%. And I don't think there's really any way to resolve that issue, but it certainly is true that it seems about 19,000 of the colonists joined the military, joined the British military, and fought against independence. So that second section was aimed at trying to persuade people in North America to fight on behalf of North American independence. And of course, that third section, the one about the British cousins, was directed at them. Hey, you ought to consider that your government shouldn't be so harshly attempting to subjugate us, because it's not only our contention that we have valid arguments to make on behalf of local self-government here in North America, but also that we gave you every opportunity to please us, to placate us, to satisfy us that our rights would continue to be safe if we remained in the British Empire, and essentially you did not respond. So we don't think that we've really had a choice but to declare our independence. And finally, that last section, of course, where they actually declared independence and claimed all the properties of any other state, has to be seen as being directed at potential allies, potential lenders. The operative language at the end, that bit about these colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, was not actually written by members of Congress. That was the language of the instructions sent by Virginia's government to Virginia's congressmen. They were told, declare independence, say that the colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. Because Virginia had established its independence, people there thought on May 15th with a resolution to adopt a Republican Constitution in their ruling Revolutionary Convention, but certainly by June 29th when they inaugurated Patrick Henry as their first Republican governor, the Virginians had established their constitutional independence for all to see. So thinking probably of the idea expressed famously on another occasion by Ben Franklin that we must all hang together or we will certainly all hang separately. The Virginians did not want to be the only independent former colony in North America, and that's why they instructed their congressmen to declare independence. So when Congressman Lee from Virginia, Richard Henry Lee, stood up and said, Mr. President, I move that we declare that these colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, an informed observer might well have expected that any resolution they made to that effect would include exactly that language. So they were the ones who had been instructed to declare independence, the Virginians were, and they got exactly what their convention had called for, a resolution of Congress to exactly that effect. That's another way to understand the Declaration of Independence, of course, is as a declaration of independence. The chief draftsman, the fellow who is often called the author of the Declaration of Independence, was Thomas Jefferson. Of course, he was not the author. He wrote a draft that was then revised somewhat by a committee before being revised extensively by the Congress as a whole. And essentially, we've understood that Jefferson's contribution here was that his felicitous language put the American argument very memorably. So where other people tended to write in a wordier and clunkier style, Jefferson had the rhetorical and concision virtues that made the American argument memorable. He was the chief draftsman, and as I say, the committee helped to revise it before taking it to the full convention. Some of the most famous language in the Declaration actually was not from Jefferson's pen, but we have, for example, an early draft with interlineations by John Adams and Ben Franklin, where some of the famous language actually came from the pen of Franklin, not from the pen of Jefferson directly. Jefferson was chosen for the role of chief draftsman of the Declaration of Independence by the chairman of the committee, John Adams of Massachusetts. Adams went to Jefferson, the youngest member of the committee, and said to him that he thought that Jefferson ought to write the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson at first objected. Well, why would I do it? I'm younger than you. I'm less experienced than you. I'm not the chairman. And Adams recalled later that he gave four reasons. First, Jefferson was a Virginian. I'm sorry, three reasons. First, Jefferson was a Virginian, and this was extremely important. It had been Adams a little over a year earlier who had insisted on a Virginian commander-in-chief of the army. And the reason for that was that Adams feared that if a New England man were made commander-in-chief of the army, or even a New Yorker were, people outside the Northeast might see the Revolution as chiefly Yankees' quarrel, that Southerners, Virginians, and people further south would say, well, that's their problem. So Adams, when it came to the Declaration of Independence, wanted a Virginian for this task too. Secondly, Adams said he was obnoxious, by which he meant not that he had that kind of personality, although he apparently did, but that he had been advocating, loudly advocating independence for so long, and at such, that is, for so many months, and at such length in speeches and just insisting at every opportunity in Congress, the people had come to had become tired of hearing it from him, that he was obnoxious in this sense. So Jefferson, on the other hand, was not that kind of a person. In fact, Adams later said that in the years that the two of them sat together in Congress, he had never heard Jefferson say more than two sentences together. Jefferson tended to do his work in writing and in committees and not to stand up and give long speeches or any speeches. So besides that, Adams said of Jefferson, "You're a better penman. You're a better writer. You have the capacity for saying these things in a memorable way that can inspire people, that can impress people, that can persuade people, not only abroad, but in the colonies to support us." He had this idea, Adams did, from having read an earlier product of Jefferson that was what's called a summary view of the rights of British America, which actually Jefferson did not entitle a summary view of the rights of British America. But what had happened was that in 1774, it became clear that Virginia's General Assembly was going to send members, it was going to send delegates to the First Continental Congress. And so Jefferson drafted what he hoped would be instructions for Virginia's congressmen. It turned out that because he was unwell, he was not able himself personally to go to Williamsburg and present this to the General Assembly, but he sent it, and people in the General Assembly decided, well, this is a little too forward, but they went ahead and published it under the title invented by them, A Summary View of the Rights of British America. And what it did was to stake the claim that Virginia and the other colonies had been founded by the colonists under their own steam, through their own effort, with their own money, that Parliament had always been a foreign body to them. And essentially what he was saying was that the colonies had been in a kind of dominion status. What in the 19th century British Empire would be called a dominion status from the very beginning, so that the only remaining constitutional link between the colonies and the mother country was the monarchy, was King George III. So it seemed obvious to Adams that Jefferson knew the argument, had that in mind, and was the type of fellow who could put it in really great language. Besides that, A Summary View of the Rights of British America was the kind of confrontational rhetoric that Adams really appreciated. And although Jefferson's personality and interpersonal relations would have given you no idea that he wrote this way, yet certainly this is the kind of person Adams wanted writing the Declaration of Independence. So with that in mind, we come to the next question. What did it mean to call this document a Declaration of Independence? Notice, when we think of declaring something, we don't think of actually doing it. And Pauline Mayer, who's the author of an excellent book on this subject, American Scripture, notes that in English tradition, a declaration was simply an announcement of a pre-existing situation. So that's consistent with the idea that Jefferson, in A Summary View of the Rights of British America, had staked out the general American argument that the colonies had been essentially dominions in the British Empire, or in Virginia's and other early colonies' case, in the English Empire, then the British Empire, from their very beginnings. And what they were doing now was simply noting that in case the government displeased them, they had a right to replace it. The government's purpose was to protect their rights, and they had a duty, essentially. Certainly they had the opportunity to replace the government if it did not protect their rights. So Mayer's argument is that the declaration didn't actually do anything itself, but announced what was already true. We come then to the question, well, was this a founding document? Was this the document that set up the United States? And I think the first thing to notice about this, it's not a very common point to make, but it seems to me obvious, is that the Continental Congress did not have power to adopt a political philosophy and say, Americans are going to be devoted to this. The Continental Congress was simply, as John Adams on another occasion described it, a meeting place of ambassadors. Sovereignty lay in the states. The state legislatures exercised the full authority of government, and the people of the states were ultimately in charge of shaping their governments. So unless they had intentionally delegated to the central government power to enunciate some philosophical position to which America must ever after be devoted, then Congress didn't have any authority to do that. And no such thing had happened Besides that, we wouldn't think of a body like the Congress as being empowered to take this kind of epical step anyway, because the Congress of 1776 was not what we think of when we hear the word Congress. Today, in the United States Congress is made up of representatives. It's a bicameral legislature. One house apportioned geographically, with each state having an equal voice, and the other house apportioned by population, with each state allocated a number of representatives reflecting its relative population or its share of the overall population. But the Continental Congress was nothing like that. The number of people from a given state had nothing to do with its population. The people who were in the Continental Congress in 1776 had not been elected. In fact, there had been no opportunity for the people in general to pass on Jefferson's and the Congress's statement of political principles. And even the legislatures arguably did not have authority to do this. Certainly the people had not entrusted them with this responsibility. So if this had been a founding document, the other important point to note is, if it had been a founding document, John Adams would not have delegated the responsibility for doing this to Thomas Jefferson. He would have done it himself. He would have drafted the thing himself. The reason Adams didn't draft it himself is that he thought he had more important things to do. The Congress was organizing and trying to fund the war, and was also trying to conduct diplomatic affairs with various countries that might be hoped or were already supporting the United States, and Adams was worried or concerned about that. So one way of understanding that he gave this task to the least experienced, the youngest member of the committee, is that he might have thought, well, this guy, unlike Franklin, unlike Roger Sherman from Connecticut, another member of the committee, a very important member of Congress, unlike Adams himself, Jefferson doesn't really have anything else that's that important to do. So if it had been that important, it wouldn't have been, the authority to draft the Declaration wouldn't have been delegated to Jefferson. The Declaration of Independence, another important discovery about it, is that it was meant to be read aloud. It wasn't meant to be read in silence over a long period of time in your study, or to have you read a couple of paragraphs of it and then check out what's on TV, or talk to the wife, or play with the dog, or come back to it later. Instead, we know from a penetrating study by a Stanford University literature professor named Fliegelman, published I think in 1993, that Jefferson imagined the Declaration of Independence being read in large groups. And the way that Fliegelman discovered this was by finding a very early copy of the Declaration of Independence with breath marks on it. Having found those, he recognized that Jefferson, a devoted student of the ancient Greek language, must have intended that those breath marks be used for stress in reading this thing aloud. And in fact, the first time the Declaration was promulgated to the public, that was done by having somebody go out in the street, from a balcony in Philadelphia, then the largest town in the country, and read it to a throng of people. The Declaration of Independence is often nowadays considered Jefferson's declaration. It was not widely credited to Jefferson until the 1790s. In fact, people didn't really think of it as being that important, what the Declaration of Independence said prior to the 1790s. And the reason it became important then was that the Republican Party, the Jeffersonian Republican Party, had decided it wanted to associate Jefferson's, that is their leaders, or at least their titular leaders, name with the Declaration of Independence. So if George Washington and Alexander Hamilton are the chief Federalists, how can we counter that? Well, our guy wrote the Declaration of Independence. I mentioned at the very beginning of this talk that people have often misunderstood the inspiration for the Declaration of Independence, or misattributed the credit for inspiring the Declaration of Independence to John Locke. There's an outstanding recent study of Roger Sherman of Connecticut, one of those five men on the committee with Adams and Jefferson, the total of five of them, to draft the Declaration of Independence. What Mark David Hall, the author of this new Sherman biography, demonstrates is that although language such as nature and nature's God or divine providence or the grand ruler of the universe, the kind of references to the deity that you find in the Declaration of Independence can indeed be squared with a Lockean deist's worldview, that is, are indeed consistent with Jefferson's private opinions, they're also consistent with Calvinism. So apparently Calvinists, among whom you would find the majority of white people in America in 1776, the majority of them were Calvinists, not only in New England, but in the country as a whole, the majority of white people were Calvinists. Calvinists, too, believed that men were given certain rights by their creator, that government was instituted to protect those rights. And in fact, they believed that in case the government failed to do that, it not only was the right, but it was the duty of good citizens to overthrow such a government. So, as I said, the Declaration was credited to Jefferson beginning in the 1790s, but the fact of its association with Jefferson has meant since the resuscitation of the reputation of John Locke in the first or beginning of the second quarter of the 20th century has meant that people have misunderstood it. And in fact, the far larger number of people in Congress who were Calvinists than the number who were Lockean when the Declaration was adopted could easily subscribe to it too. Roger Sherman was a devout Congregationalist and would have had no objection to and would have been endorsing the claims about government's responsibilities, people's rights, and the act that the states were taking that you find in the Declaration of Independence. Not only that, but apparently the kind of oblique references to God that are sprinkled through the Declaration of Independence are also consistent with Calvinism. And in fact, even John Calvin sometimes used references like that. So again, according to Hall in this very fine new book, we need not think of the Declaration as being this deist creation, although it was the kind of language that deists could use too. Anyway, after he had read the Declaration of Independence and Congress had voted to adopt the Declaration of Independence, John Adams, who was in the habit of doing this, wrote a letter to his very unusual wife. His wife, Abigail, was highly educated in politics and other things, and this was unusual even for an elite woman in the late 18th century. But John and Abigail have an extensive correspondence they've left to us, and in it we find it two of them confiding in each other on all kinds of questions. So John wrote to his wife and said, "Today was a great day in American history. This will be remembered. It'll be celebrated every year. People are going to have fireworks, and they're going to have public parades, and it'll be a wonderful thing, the great epoca of our nation, July 2nd. So what John Adams didn't realize, of course, was that the thing wouldn't be made public until July 4th. But he was right on the money when it came to the question what people were going to think of making the country independent. As I've tried to indicate, however, the idea that the country's national philosophy was being established by some group of demigods led by the author, quote-unquote, the author, on July 4th, 1776, is just mistaken. And in fact, in his old age, Adams came to resent it and tried to play down the significance of what Congress had done because he thought that Jefferson's reputation had been inflated unfairly by the Republican Party in the 1790s in connection with his role in writing the Declaration of Independence, and that, not coincidentally, that John Adams' reputation had been unfairly reduced as a result of this encomia to Jefferson.